Hey everyone, welcome to the Inside Out podcast, the show where I talk to people about what's going on the inside and get it out into the open. I'm Laura Stembridge and I will be exploring how people cope with the difficult times in their lives and what they do to maintain happiness on a day-to-day basis. I've got another brilliant show lined up for you today, especially if you're a music or a football fan. I'm going to be talking to John Smith, best known as football's super agent. John has had an incredible career in both the music and sporting worlds. He knows the world of football like no one else. He's done deals with the likes of Rupert Murdoch and he's managed superstars including Maradona. John's got an incredible story to tell. His journey hasn't been straightforward, but what he has achieved is nothing short of amazing. I cannot wait to sit down with John and have a really deep and honest conversation with him. But before we kick off, for those of you that perhaps may not have heard of Inside Out, it's an app that allows you to access coaching and therapy via video, on demand, anywhere, anytime, any place. Inside Out makes the search for therapists and coaches really easy. By completing a simple questionnaire, we connect you with those that are skilled and have the expertise to help you. So go take a look at the app. You can find it on the App Store, the Google Play Store, by searching for Inside Out. Or you can find us on all the regular social media channels, Instagram, Facebook, and alike. So now it's time for the show. Let's go and meet John. Grab a coffee, make yourself comfortable, and hope you enjoy listening. Okay, so hi everyone, and welcome to the Inside Out podcast. Today I'm here with a very charming, very lovely John Smith. Some of you may know him as football's super agent. So welcome to the Inside Out podcast, John. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Before we dive into these podcasts, we always ask all our guests 10 quickfire questions, and that's so that our lovely listeners can get to know you on a personal scale before we dive into the actual content and what we're going to be talking about
always
today.
Always a bit worrying that. Think of the first thing that comes into your head.
10 yeah, questions.
Fire away.
Fire away. Okay, perfect. So what's the first thing you did when you woke up this morning?
Normally, I get up and I do some sort of, not yoga, but some sort of mental physical stretches.
Which football team do you support?
Arsenal.
Beach or mountains?
Oh, beach.
Queen or Stones?
Stones.
What's the most exciting piece of news you've had this week?
One of my children did a really good deal, and there's nothing, if you're a daddy or a mummy, there is nothing better than your children doing well. And somebody once said to me, and it's absolutely true, you're only as happy as your unhappiest child. Today I react to them and their circumstances on a daily, weekly, monthly basis.
Where's your favourite place to relax and unwind?
I've got a little cottage down in Sussex. Near me is a little hill. I wander to the top of the hill, it's at the top of the South Downs, and on my right is the ocean, and in front of me is the little village, and on the left is the South Downs, and there's a bench right there. And in fact, there's another little bit of it further along, which is even nicer. And I've said to my wife, when I eventually pop off, just put me that bench right there. I'll always be there. If ever you want to talk to me, I'll always be there, because that's the best view in the world. It's my little village and the sea and the hills and life before me. And I can just cogitate.
That sounds really idyllic, although I'm not sure, given the answer, that's necessarily an appropriate thing to say.
Well, it's probably not so good in the pouring rain either, but it's a moment occasionally.
Sounds nice. What's the biggest challenge you've had to overcome?
From as early as I can remember, I can't remember being able to speak. I had a chronic stammer, and overcoming that, and in a world of communication, being able to communicate is the biggest achievement that I've ever had.
What day in your life would you like to relive?
Every day is my birthday, that's what I'd like to relive. Christmas Day and my birthday, and then live it again on Boxing Day.
What's the best gift someone could ever give you?
I think Bill Kerr gave me that when he gave me my speech back.
And what advice would you give your teenage self?
Don't be afraid. Really, do not be afraid. Nothing is forever. And however bad it is, don't be afraid, because somewhere around some corner in the not too distant future, it's going to get better.
Okay, so your career spanned over 25 years. You're known as the official super agent, bringing football into the Premier League and developing that up, you know, getting Sky involved, doing the deal with Rupert Murdoch. So just tell us a little bit about yourself and your career to date.
I was quite lucky because having been treated for this speech disfluency that I suffered for so many years, I was very fortunate to be then super confident. And the first love of my life was actually music. And I went into music, and I was, again, fortune maybe favors the brave, but I was led to a scene, inverted commas, called Northern Soul in the 70s, which was a happening. And I got very friendly with the originators of it, and we produced music from it. And we had, I think, about 9 or 10 hit records, one after the other, after the other, after the other. Oh, wow. That was the beginning of it all, really. We made some big stuff. And then I eventually ended up working with Donna Summer and Billy Ocean and all the Northern Soul stuff, Wiggins Ovation, Wiggins Chosen Few. Eventually, I sold out. I was made a good offer by an American publishing company in 1981. And I sold out and retired at the age of 29.
That's quite an achievement.
Actually, you know what? It was, I have to say this, it was actually the worst week of my life because my first wife was very sick at the time. She had leukemia and she was recovering from a bone marrow transplant.
I'm really sorry to hear that.
And sadly, she died that week on the Wednesday. And a very dear friend of mine called Tony Simons, who is also no longer with us, helped sell my business for me during the time she was in hospital. And we concluded that deal and I became that erstwhile millionaire on the Friday. And it absolutely meant nothing to me. However wonderful the status, and I don't want to talk down £1 million now because it's a lot of money now, but in those days, it was an even bigger amount of money.
Yeah, of course.
And so for me, it was life-defining. And it meant absolutely nothing. In fact, I spent the next 3 years drinking some of it away in the bottom of Whiskey Boskal because I just couldn't, you know, couldn't believe that she'd gone.
You've got two extreme emotions
within
2 days of each
just
other.
Just learning to deal with that. Yeah. And I think if that had happened today, I would have had a lot more help. I had a lot of help around me. I had a lot of friends, a lot of relatives, a lot of very, very warm, lovely people. But I was brought up in a time when the man didn't really show emotion and, you know, stood bolt upright and you know, you were the rock of Gibraltar. Mm. That was the rock in my head. So I had to be that person. So I suffered on my own. Not because nobody cared. Lots of people cared. But I went away to suffer. And I just said to everyone, I'll be all right. I'll be all right. And today, I think I would have reacted completely differently. I would have shared some of that burden. Because, you know, I said I lived in the bottom of a whiskey bottle for 3 years. I probably could have shortened that by 2. Or even 2.5 years, had I have shared that burden. You know, I suffered because I, in a way, because I wanted to suffer, because Lee had suffered, and she was the most wonderful person, didn't deserve that. And here was I alive, and I couldn't come to terms with that. It took me a long time to do that.
I mean, that's a huge thing to have to go through, you know, in your late 20s, early 30s, and especially at a time where, you know, mental health and bereavement wasn't really being talked about. You know, the support units, like you've alluded to, not necessarily being there and people being willing to listen. So,
it's those are people don't understand sometimes how, but bereavement is life changing forever. Mm. So it is absolutely like that cut on your arm, on your wrist, on your hand, on your leg, whatever, which hurts like hell. Eventually, the pain goes away, but the scar never leaves you. You can look at the scar and remember how you got hurt. And so I, even today, 38 years later, I can sit and think, it was the anniversary of Lee passing away last month. Those anniversaries bring you back to times which were very sad and times which were very happy as well. Some of the good times that we had, of which there were many, but of course the last memories is of somebody dying and suffering. And I can taste those memories 38 years later.
Yeah, they don't go away.
They just don't go. And I think certainly with bereavement, people need to understand that the counselling is for now, but actually you need the tools to deal with the counselling that you won't get 10, 20, 30 years later. And there'll be moments where you will be as vividly in emotional pain as you were way back when it happened. It just configures in a different way in your life.
Yeah, so you were 29, you sold your company, and then unfortunately, you know, you had a really sad or really bad time of it for the next 3 years. A couple of questions, I guess. How or what was the trigger point for moving out of that bad frame of mind? And then, you know, what was next for you moving into your 30s?
Well, part of my problem was that I had nothing to do. So I'd sold out. I didn't particularly want to start anything again. I wasn't in the mind to start anything again. So I traveled a lot. I went around the world, in fact, largely on my own. In a way, because there was so much love and affection coming out at me, I wanted to breathe oxygen. I wanted to just come to terms with it all. So for the first 2 or 3 months, I was in a pretty bad place. The trigger point that made me get better was the trigger point that is in everybody. There is a part of your inner being that says, you've suffered enough. It's time to take a step in another direction. You have to live. Otherwise, you curl up and die. Mm. And I didn't want to curl up and die. I was only 29. I wanted to live with a memory of Lee that wasn't painful. So I made a conscious decision to put myself back into society again. And the hard bit then was to stop the fact that I was living in the bottom of a whiskey bottle. I couldn't. I mean, I have to admit this, and I guess if this goes out publicly, it'll be they'll come and nick me. But I'd even, you know, get in a car and drive and not realize the following morning that I was probably still well inebriated. But in those days, I guess I didn't care as much for anything other than for me. That's all I was concerned about was me and getting myself better and getting myself through this. We live in a much more caring world now. And I think that caring would have been shared and my pain would have been shared.
How did you get yourself through that? You know, what did it look like week by week, month by month?
I think having made the decision that it was time to step forward, I knew that I was on a slope and it was slippery and I could slide back down again. And I just had to make sure I was strong enough to be able to pick myself up. So I surrounded myself with some cool people, my brother Phil and just friends who were I was particularly close to. And I had a home in Los Angeles at the time as well. In the 80s in LA, life was a bit bonkers, really. I think most of them are dead now. I shouldn't laugh at that, but you know, that they were a crazy bunch. So I could get out of myself there by just getting on an aeroplane. And I consciously made the decision not to feel guilty for being happy. And I think once I got over that, I was slowly on my way back.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting thought, you know, not what you just said there about not feeling guilty for being happy. I'm sure anyone that's gone through a bereavement or any
form of depression, actually, yeah. You know, don't feel bad that you feel good.
Don't forget that it's okay to love yourself.
For
and
sure.
To take care
no,
of yourself.
You need to love yourself. Yeah, that's the first requisite. You know, the religious amongst us, of which I am not, will tell you have to love God first. I don't believe that. I believe you love yourself first. You can't love God until you love yourself.
It was really interesting. We were actually talking the other day on the podcast with the Naked Professor about this whole idea of loving yourself. And how, you know, at school, you know, as a teenager, when you're really influential and you're finding yourself, it's so easy to fall out of love with yourself because you don't want to be the person that's seen to be in love with themselves, you know, and then ultimately bullied.
I actually created a different person. My real name is Jonathan Andrew Smith. And because I couldn't talk when I was younger, I couldn't say Athan. So I became John Smith. And John Smith was the sufferer. So I used to wake up sometimes and say, today I'm going to find Jonathan. And Jonathan was my nice little young boy that I was when I was happy. I didn't have to talk to anybody when I was a kid, except at school, and even then I used to get the mickey taken out of me a little bit. But I was also a very fast runner, so I represented Great Britain as a junior, so I used to get that sort of, shall we bully him? Well, no, because he's actually doing something that we'd all like to do. So I got away with that. So I used to say to myself, okay, this week, today, whatever it is, I'm going to find Jonathan. Jonathan is going to live today. And finding Jonathan made me happy because he was a happy little soul.
I really like that idea of having, like, you know, a sort of an inner persona of someone that you're, you know, your happy person and choosing to be that rather than to be kind of, you know, all self-fulfilling with the negative thoughts and vibes that are around you.
I nearly called my book Finding Jonathan.
Oh, really?
But the publisher said, oh, it doesn't really mean anything. Call it The Deal. People will understand it. So I did. But for me, finding Jonathan was and is important. Even today, there are times when I need to be alone with Jonathan.
Maybe there's a second book there in the making.
Maybe.
So The Deal is your autobiography and looks at your life as a super agent. So how did that all come about? How did you move from where you were in the music industry and into football specifically?
I said to you just now, I used to go to Los Angeles a lot. Mm. And while I was there, I used to love going to watch the LA Raiders because they were the antithesis of, you know, sportsmanship. They were the bad boys. But it was a family entertainment. And back in England in the 80s, football was not dying, but people were dying. Mm. People were dying in stadia, which is, you know, it doesn't get much worse than that. And so football was in like a black place. And what I wanted to do is I wanted to come back to England and bring with, if I could bottle that and bring it back to England. And funnily enough, I did bottle it. I met a wonderful guy called Steve Wright, who was the new head of global, or I think Northwest Europe marketing, whatever his position was, at Coca-Cola. And he and I discussed about how we could turn football into the fun sport that their American football was in America. And I was fortunate enough to know some well-known footballers here from my previous existence. And one of them, Paul Marin, and I started this company called First Artist. And he'd just left the England football team. And they had an agent at the time, a lovely man called Harry Swales. And he was getting older and wanted to retire. And long story short, we ended up managing the England football team. And by an even longer story, which I won't go into now, a few weeks later, I landed the deal to help look after Diego Maradona. So I was, all of a sudden, I'd been in business for 10 minutes and I had two of the biggest icons in global
amazing.
Football. I then contacted my mate, Steve, at Coca-Cola, and we put together, I'd like to think we put the fun back in football again. You know, we brought a lot of money from Coca-Cola into the game, and we did ridiculously fun things with the England team and with, you know, I laugh about this, you know, I did Diego Maradona's first Coke deal, but it was the it was the black stuff, not the white
drink.
Stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, the drink rather than the...
And I mean, for instance, with England, it was a pretty closed shop because the Football Association said to me, you can't do anything other than, you know, local small deals because we have Umbro as the all-embracing sponsor. So Steve and I set about becoming disruptors. We were probably the first marketing disruptors in sport in England. So what used to happen is Coca-Cola on an England game would buy advertising boards around the ground. And Bobby Robson, lovely, lovely man that he was, allowed me to tell the England team in the dressing room before the game, unless it was a really important game and then I wasn't allowed in, where the boards were. So when you scored, run to the boards and celebrate in front of the Coca-Cola boards. So you'd see things like Paul Gascoigne was the best at this. You'd see England score and he'd throw his arms up in there and then look, spent ages looking around with the other lads as to where did Smithy say the boards was? Because it was, it's over there. Oh, we'll go over there. And so they'd charge 60 yards down the field and celebrate in front of them. And I thought that was fantastic. And Coca-Cola then said to me, that's very good, John, but they celebrated in front of the board so nobody could see the board. So I went, okay, I don't want to do with that. We'll have to figure that out. Maybe we'll celebrate next to the board or something. And then Paul Gascoigne said to me, I'll dive down in front of it. I'll dive down by the board and you'll see it. And he did. And the England team dived on top of it. And that's how diving in football began.
So it all came back.
Yep.
Oh, well, there we go. I've learned something new today.
little bit of football. I was going to say football history. It's not as important as to make historical fact, but it's a little bit of, if we all played Trivial Pursuit, it could be a good Trivial Pursuit question.
I feel like that would be a really good pub quiz question.
Yes, indeed. How did diving start?
At the moment, the statistics are showing that the number of footballers approaching the PFA, I think they actually increased by 50% over the last year. Does that surprise you?
Yeah. Yeah, it does. I mean, I didn't just say those words just now because I thought they were nice words to say. I genuinely believe, and I've been party to sitting down with players and conversations about when you transfer them, their lifestyle, and also I've sat down with many of the players whose careers are coming to an end because they've got injury and how they mentally come to terms with that. I mean, I remember even personally, I've had a foot operation and a knee operation recently, and I'm 66 years of age. So, you know, my body's not, my mind still thinks I'm 27, but my body isn't. So just for me in my life, coming to terms with the fact that, you know, I used to sprint down the beach in Spain, I should be able to do that just now. But, you know, I'm not going to be challenging Usain Bolt anytime soon again. So, you know, just coming to terms with the fact that you are older and that you have to change your mental well-being to accommodate your physicality. And I think footballers are the same. You know, there's inevitably a player that's had a big knee injury will never be the same player again, ever. Mm. He would have lost half a yard. So you have to get that player's mind to accept that, okay, that my game has to change. It has to be, my feet have to be quicker than my mind is, or words to that effect. It's, I guess the mind drives everything, but the feet have to be that much quicker because the ability to turn isn't as easy as it was pre-op. So your feet and your mind have to work faster to get over the physical issues which you've just incurred. And that's just growing pains in a footballer's life, but that's life too, and you've got to manage it. You don't manage that right, and you lose your confidence. You lose your confidence, you don't play very well, and you're out of the team.
So I think, you know, from what I can tell, from the reports that are out there at the moment, you know, obviously, when we talk about mental health, we talk about stress, anxiety, depression, we talk about self-harming, we talk about suicidal thoughts. What we often don't talk about is addiction. And whilst, you know, some addictions you can actually see, you know, someone turned up to training and they were still under the influence, or they were spaced out from, you know, sort of taking drugs. When people are coming in, you know, all consumed with the worry of debt because of a gambling addiction, it's a lot easier to put a mask on that, and therefore harder for people to pick up on it.
The thing that really worries me, because I went through it after Lee died, and I've seen other people go through it. And we talked about Paul Gascoigne just now, and he certainly went through it and is going through it. Is obsessional behavior. Our conscious self, and I'm aware of this because I was helped to get over my issues of pain post-operation and earlier the bereavement of my mother and my wife. Your everyday conscious mind acts and reacts to circumstances around you, and you can manage it normally. However, there's this other little beast in you somewhere. They call it the alter ego. So you look out the window and you see a blue sky and you go, yay, nice day. And this part of you says, yeah, there's a cloud over there. It's probably going to rain later. Or you step up to take a penalty and you get yourself in that right frame of mind and you're going to put it in the top corner, and something in you says, you're going to miss this. That is cataclysmic in your life. And I found somebody, I was very fortunate to find somebody who was a hypnotherapist. So she wasn't like a therapist as such, she was a hypnotherapist. And she was able to take my subconscious mind back to pain-free times when those circumstances weren't relevant. Let me just give you a brief example. After Lee died, 6 or 7 weeks after Lee died, I went to see a friend of mine at RCA Records in Bedford Square in London. I'm driving my car, and I've never, ever, ever, ever had claustrophobia. In fact, I used to love being in big crowds. When I was younger, I used to go to Arsenal, and I'd sit in the tube. I wouldn't even sit, I'd stand in there. I'd be carried along in a wave of people. You know, there was no oxygen in the place. It was fun. I'm driving to see my friend at RCA Records, and I get to the car park, and it's a spiral downwards car park, so you just go round and round and round and round. I got halfway down, and I couldn't face it anymore. I stopped the car in the middle of that driveway and ran out to get oxygen. I had acquired claustrophobia. From where it came, I didn't know. It must have been a reaction to Lee passing away. So, and because God's got a sense of humor, some 8-10 weeks later, I'm in New York. I get caught in an elevator on my own when a power outage in southern Manhattan, and I'm there for 4.5 hours in the pitch black. So now I'm really claustrophobic. In fact, I said when the fire brigade got me out, I said, you know what I'm going to do? They're going to take me home to the hotel and everything. I said, no, don't do that. I need to go on the subway. Because if I don't go on the subway, I'll never, ever, ever do this again. And they said, gee, you're mad, but that's what you want to do. Went on the subway and the train got stuck in the tunnel.
Oh my gosh.
So now I'm triply claustrophobic. So And that really affected me because I didn't like elevators. I didn't like subways. I didn't like anything that put me in a place. I mean, we're talking in a big wide room here. If I was in a much smaller room, I wouldn't like it. So this wonderful hypnotherapist managed to take me back to before Lee died. And that hadn't happened. I hadn't been caught in that car park in Bedford Square. So when that occasionally slides into my mind, the immediate switch goes on that, but remember when you used to enjoy all those fun times at Arsenal when, you know, you were in this big crowd and it was fun. And that overcomes it. So there is an ability, I think, to be able to address the mental issues which are really painful in your life. If you have faith in someone who can take you to a place where whenever the negative over consumes you, that you can actually say, no, this is the relevant passage of my life that I refer to now. This is fun. This is okay.
Yes, it's almost like training your mind to be able to go back to that place where you're happy and you're confident, and to bypass all the negative thoughts.
The extreme of that is these nutters that jump into the Arctic Ocean in swimming shorts into -320 and don't feel cold. But those are, you know, that's another mindset.
Yeah, so obviously, you know, during your time as an agent, you were buying, selling players into clubs, you know, a lot of fast-paced, high-pressure deals, I would imagine, both for you personally, but also, you know, a high-pressured, anxious time for the players, especially those that were being exited from clubs. Was there ever any thought or consideration given to their emotional well-being and how that exit out of that particular club might have affected them?
You know, it's a really good question because nobody asks that question. So there was a time during a transfer window in January where, I don't know whether you've watched the end of the transfer windows, they trots along, and then you get to the last day and mayhem breaks out because everyone thinks, oh, okay, I've got to have that. And that deal moves, that situation opens up gap there and everyone charges into that. So it's the 48 hours before the window closes is a bit mad. This particular January, some years ago, this player was being sold by a Premier League club to another football club. So obviously the message is, we don't want you anymore. So he goes off, has his medical. The football club in question realised that actually, sorry, the purchasing club realised that actually we're going to buy someone else instead because we actually found some, because this mayhem has opened up a gap and that person's now available. So they junk the deal and this poor player is left to have to go, having said goodbye to all his teammates, and I'm going and I'm moving and I'm doing this, it's exciting, go back as a reject. Now, how does he deal with that in an emotional, high-energy sport / business that needs you to be mentally so together when you walk on the pitch? When you cross that white line, nothing should matter to you other than you're really good and you're going to be so good today, or words to that effect.
Yeah.
This guy comes back as a reject, knowing that his manager doesn't want him, his club don't want him, and he's only there because the deal fell down because the other club didn't want him either. And, you know, we took in our own time, we took a bit of, you know, arm round, talked to him about, you know, its circumstances, you know, your time will come, it'll going to be fine, you've got plenty of time, don't worry. But, you know, he's got to go home and live with that. He's got to go home to his wife and family as a reject. That's tough.
Yeah, it's got to be really tough. So, I mean, sort of looking at other sports now, so just across the board, you know, when the athletes move from being in a structured environment where it's training, it's performing, it's competing, to then, you know, a retirement, be that injury-induced early retirement or just be that a natural retirement, you know, that transition period can be really hard. And we're seeing a lot of athletes now come out speaking about how they suffered with depression, loss of identity, loss of self-esteem, not sure what they're going to be doing, not feeling like they're any good at anything because they've not known anything beyond their world of sport. I mean, that must be an incredibly hard situation to deal with as well.
It is. It's compounded by the fact that, especially if you're at the top of the game, your 70,000 pound a week doesn't tail off and become 60, 50, 40, 30 and go down. You have time then to remanage your financial existence. Mm-hmm. It falls off a cliff. So on the On the 30th of June that year, when your contract ends, your 70 grand a week stops, and your income from the 1st of July is a big round number, zero.
Mm-hmm.
And inevitably, if you've been successful at a Premier League club, for instance, or La Liga in Spain at the top level, or any of the big leagues, you've got a number of people around you. Some people call them hangers-on, some people call them friends, some people call them assistants, but they drop away. I mean, I sold out a few years ago, and I sold out fairly successfully. And even I found that a lot of the invites, a lot of the people that were around me, calling, doing, being, just slowly evaporated. In fact, some evaporated the next day. So, you know, you have to manage that, the fact that the phone doesn't ring so often and your bank balance is going down. And as you quite rightly say, in some cases, they've got no training of what to have done before. So an object lesson in invest your money wisely, preferably into real estate that you can manage with an accountant. So you've got something to get your head into. Attach yourself to a cause, a charity, something like this maybe, to give you a raison d'etre. Everybody needs to get out of bed most days, not every day. Last Sunday it rained all day and we lay in bed and watched movies and did nothing, which is, that's important too.
It's important to have those days.
Four Mars bars later as well. Everybody has to have a reason to love themselves. We talked about that before. Mm-hmm. And to respect their ability to live a life worthwhile beyond their career.
I just think there's so much more that we can be doing to support those athletes through the transition, you know, whether that's equipping them with skills, whether it's creating opportunities, but just giving them that sense of fulfillment.
You know, sporting bodies should have lifestyle assistance in the mix, so that when you stop, I mean, look, there are boxers that stop punching people and can't stop punching people because that's all they know. So they get into scrapes out of the ring when they stop fighting. So I think people like that also need help. I'm not saying people like that casting them as bad people. It's just, you know, you are conditioned and that conditioning stops one day and then you're no longer necessary and it's no longer necessary. So I think you need help to be able to steer yourself, sometimes just for a short space of time. I mean, what must it be like coming out of the army? I mean, you've been in the most horrendous situations in Afghanistan and Syria and what have you, and then suddenly you're back on Civvy Street, and you're supposed to react normally as you walk past some stupid thug outside McDonald's. You know, it's a difficult, really difficult environment.
I was actually at a talk last night with Jason Fox from SES, Who Dares Wins, Foxy, yes, and he was talking about that exact process of having left the armed forces and going back into
with
civilian
very little
life.
Help, I think, if any help at all, I don't know. To be sure, but I think that's potentially cataclysmic because you're a walking killer.
It's equipping people with the skills Correct. That they need, with the content to look at.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, really, the health ministry should have something like this.
Yeah.
I mean, it's under stress anyway, the NHS, but it should have a service like this. It's just as important as physical medicine.
Yeah. I mean, I love the work that the Young Princes and...
Yeah, I think they're doing a great job.
Yeah, the Heads Together campaign.
It's so important.
Yeah.
And it's just... But we are aware of it now. We're much more aware than we have been, probably ever than ever before.
Yeah.
But it's not yet translating into actionable support. Yeah. Other than in pockets.
And this isn't just a problem here in the UK. I mean, it's a global problem. I don't know if you know the statistics, but one in four people across the world suffer with a mental health condition. There's 300 million people right now suffering with depression. One suicide every 40 seconds globally.
I mean, it's astonishing. I mean, I'm amazed that my children's friends, I would say, from what I know, at least 30 to 40% of their friends have, and again, I'm going to use the word issues, have mental issues. They're not, in some cases, they're problems, but in other cases, they're just coming to terms with stuff in their life, which their parents perhaps can't help them with.
Yeah.
And outside of that, you have therapy. And that's, there should be, between your parents and therapy, there should be a best mate somewhere.
Someone that's going to listen to you.
Even if it's not your best mate, you know.
Yeah, someone to listen to you.
Someone to listen to you, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, you've been on quite a journey. You've seen the highs of selling businesses. You've seen the lows of suffering with bereavements, you know, having life-changing injuries that led to different forms of addictions. What advice would you give to people right now if they're suffering with some kind of mental health challenge and either don't know where to go to get support or are feeling like they can't speak to someone?
Never despair. And that's probably a crass statement in itself, because when you are at desperation's doorstep, you do despair. But just before you cross into that unknown place, just remember that 9 and 9/10 of times out of 10, there is an answer and a solution somewhere. It's not instant. Mm. It's not, I'll jump into church and pray and I'll walk out feeling wonderful. It's the ability, however desperate you are, to find somebody that you can talk to, even if it's the Samaritans. Just for a moment, draw breath and look at the sky, even if it's pissing with rain. You know, sometimes it's nice just standing in the pissing wet. I think it's just pulling back from the brink of desperation. Nothing is forever. And there is a more potent power in your mind that can overcome the intense negative that you're suffering. You just haven't found it yet. Don't do anything silly until you've really looked hard. And even then, don't do anything silly. But, you know, look really hard. Look inside yourself. Look around you. Somewhere in that dark corner, there's a little bit of light. It's in everybody's life. Nobody walks around in the darkness forever. And I just think it's a very easy, and in some cases, a crass thing for me to have said all that. But I genuinely believe it.
That's, you know, I couldn't have said it better myself if I tried.
Thank you.
So don't give up. You know, the Samaritans are there. They offer a great service. You know, there are always friends and family that are willing to listen to you.
And there's people like you who have gone out of your way. And there's many people like you, and which I think is a blessing for you and for everybody like you who is doing this, who are out there. Your phone numbers, your websites, your emails are all out there. You know, you can do this. Other people can look at you and go, I'm not alone. That's the biggest fear. I'm alone. And you can be in a crowd and be lonely because your head is telling you shit. And the way you deal with that shit is that you get to where it started and go behind it. If you can get behind the cause of that, it takes a lot of will, but most people have got that will. They've just got to rediscover it that moment, that time, that week, that month, whenever it is. Don't stop looking for it because it's there. If you can get behind it, you can begin to chip away at it. And as you chip away at it, the most wonderful thing happens. You actually realize that your mind actually wants to be happy again.
It's such wise words. You know, be the change you want to be.
I love that. Who coined that? Was that you? Be the change you want to be. I love that.
I don't know. I'm sure I probably heard it somewhere else.
I love that. But also just be you. Yeah. The real you is not the depressed you.
Be honest to yourself. Be true to yourself.
The real you wants to be happy. We're not born to be miserable. Mm. We're born to live. It's everyone's birthright to have a happiness. Now, we ride a journey and the tram stops at places, and sometimes you lose lots of money in that place, and sometimes you lose people, and sometimes so it injures you as you go along, because that's the way life is. But remember where you were born. You were born not to be miserable. These things are sent because life, that's what life is. Just know how much bigger everything is than the incidents of today. Even if you think it's the end of the road and you can't see any light at all, just pause and look around, and you will find light there somewhere. And then just latch onto it, because your body and your mind wants to be happy.
Yeah.
It just needs feeding.
Just find that inner light and let it keep burning. Don't give up and don't look back.
Correct. Absolutely right.
John, this has been absolutely amazing. I absolutely love talking to you today. Oh my, what a deep and candid conversation that was.
Thank you, John, for being so open and honest about your story and the mental health playing field in football. If you're a football fan and haven't yet read John's book, The Deal, I thoroughly recommend it. It's a really good read. It's also great to see that Heads Together have teamed up with the FA to launch Heads Up and combat the mental health stigma in football. So that brings us to the end of season one. What a great season it's been. It's whizzed by so quickly. I've had some really deep emotional chats with the guests. It's been incredible and I've loved meeting and chatting to every single one of them. I'd love to hear your feedback, so let me know what you've enjoyed listening to and who you'd maybe like to hear from in season two. You can do that by leaving us a review. So you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Anchor, Spotify. Just search for Inside Out on any podcast app. So that's it. Until next season, thanks again to John, all our other amazing guests, our producer, and of course, you beautiful people for listening and tuning in. See you really soon. And as always, think happy vibes and don't forget to let the inside out.